It's a pleasure to again speak at a faculty forum. My topic is an American blood libel. It did happen. Now, first of all, what is a blood libel? What are we talking about? The Jews have been accused for hundreds of years in various places of using blood in some way, shape, manner, or form as part of their rituals. Usually the accusation is that blood is used to bake what are called matzahs. That's unleavened bread that is eaten at Passover time. And for some reason or other, it has to be used as part of the ingredients. Now, first of all, matzah consists of flour and water and nothing else. That is Jewish law. Flour and water and nothing else. That's number one. Number two, the Hebrew Bible forbids the consumption of blood. When an animal is slaughtered according to Jewish law, first of all, the blood is drained from the animal. Then, once the meat has been butchered, it is soaked in salt. It's salted first and then soaked to remove the blood. So the idea that Jews would consume blood is off the wall. It really is. Nonetheless, this accusation has persisted for generations and has caused us a great deal of difficulty. The first known instance of a blood libel against the Jews is found in the writings of Appian in the early first century. He claimed that the Jews slaughtered Christians in the temple as part of their ritual. But after that, the blood libel sort of disappeared, and then it raised its ugly head in Norwich, in England, in 1144. And this is the beginning of this accusation in Europe. William of Norwich was the child who was involved. And by the way, part of the blood libel, the claim is that Jews pick particularly children and use their blood. On March 20th, which was Passover, the first blood libel in Europe against the Jews arose. The Jews of Norwich were accused of both ritual murder and blood libel after a boy, William, was found dead with stab wounds. The legend was turned into a cult, with William acquiring the status of martyr and crowds of pilgrims bringing wealth to the local church. In 1189, the Jewish deputation attending the coronation of Richard the Lionheart was attacked by the crowd, because it was felt that Jews had participated in this killing of Christians. And the Jews in 1190, many of the Jews in Norwich were actually killed, and the Jews were expelled in England in 1290 and weren't allowed to return until 1655. Now, the blood libel occurs in many, many places throughout Europe. In Blois in 1171, in Flanders in 1250, in Lincolnshire in 1255. The case, by the way, William of Norwich was made a saint. He is considered a saint in the eyes of the church to this day. In Lincolnshire in 1255, the case of Little Saint Hugh of Lincoln is mentioned by Chaucer, and thus has become well known. A child of 8 years old named Hugh, son of a woman named Beatrice, disappeared at Lincoln on the 31st of July. His body was discovered on the 29th of August, covered with filth in a pit or a well that belonged to a Jew by the name of Copen or Coppen. On being promised by John of Lexington, who happened to be present at the time, that his life would be spared if he confessed, Coppen is said to have confessed that the boy had been crucified by the Jews who had assembled at Lincoln for that purpose. King Henry III, on reaching Lincoln some 5 weeks afterward at the beginning of October, refused to carry out the promise of John of Lexington. and had Coppin executed and 91 of the Jews of Lincoln seized and sent up to London, where 18 of them were executed. The rest were pardoned at the intercession of Franciscan monks. 1267, in Margraviate of Baden, in 1270 in Alsace, in 1286 in Oberweissel in Lorraine, in Switzerland in the 1400s, in Tyrol in Austria in 1462, at Rhin near Innsbruck, a boy named Andreas Ochsner was said to have been bought by Jewish merchants and cruelly murdered by them in a forest near the city, his blood being carefully collected in vessels. The accusation of drawing off the blood without murder was not made until the beginning of the 17th century when the cult was founded. So it happened in the 15th century. In the 17th century, a cult is founded. The old inscription in the church of Rhin, dating from 1575, is distorted by fabulous embellishments, as, for example, that the money which had been paid for the boy to his godfather was found to have turned into leaves and that a lily blossomed upon his grave. The cult continued until it was officially prohibited in 1994 by the Bishop of Innsbruck. This was in Tyrol, Austria. There was one in Trentino in 1475, in Castile in 1491, in Hungary in 1494, then again in Hungary in 1529. If you're interested in the details, all you have to do is Google blood libel, and you will see all these things come up.
What exactly was prohibited? What was prohibited?
What do you mean, what was prohibited?
The prohibition was capturing Jewish boys and using them? Is that the prohibition? Or is it the idea that was prohibited? You said it was, something was
prohibited. There was a group that was formed, a cult, and that being a member of that cult was prohibited. That was banned. In Polish Lithuania in 1690, in Syria in 1840, the famous Syrian Damascus blood libel in which a Catholic monk named Father Thomas and his servant were murdered. The Jews were accused of having done that. A number of Jews from the community were arrested. They were tortured until confessions were extracted from them, and it looked like they were going to be killed until the Jewish community worldwide rose up and protested this, and eventually the thing was completely dismissed. In fact, this was perhaps the first time that the American Jewish community in 1840 band together to attempt to do something worldwide for Jews. In Rhodes in 1840, there was another one. In Hungary in 1882, in Bohemia in 1899, in Kishinev in Russia in 1903.
So what happened in these places?
What happened? What happened was that Jews were accused, and in some cases they were murdered. In other cases, it was dismissed. In Shiraz in 1910, in Kiev in Ukraine in Russia in 1911, in Poland in 1946, this is after the war, World War II, a blood libel was used as an excuse for a pogrom to kill survivors of the Holocaust. Now, so clearly it has plagued the Jewish people. Clearly it has plagued the Jewish people. What I want to focus on, and again, if you're interested in the details of each and every one of these misfortunes, you can simply Google and you will see this Wikipedia will come up and all this stuff will come up. I'm interested in focusing on what's called the Messina blood libel, which happened here in America in 1928. Again, in America in 1928. Messina is a little village in upstate New York of about 11,000 people today. It's situated in the township of the same name in the county of St. Lawrence on the extreme northern border of New York, just 3 miles from the St. Lawrence River. At this point, the St. Lawrence River forms the boundary between Canada and America. In the 19th century, Messina was primarily a farming center with little to distinguish it It was a rural place. However, and the residents were almost all Anglo-Saxon white Protestants. However, over time, a steady trickle of French Canadians began to come from Canada who were Catholic. And then there were certain Irish families that emigrated in the 1880s after the famine, the potato famine in Ireland. Things changed around the turn of the century, around 1900, when certain things were done so that it was able to harness the water power from the river. And Alcoa opened an aluminum plant there, smelting plant to extract aluminum, using that water power. Now, the plant required a lot of laborers, and it was hard and difficult work, and frankly, the local population didn't want to do it. So Alcoa was forced to import labor in order to be able to run the plant. And where did they get the recruits? They brought people in from Europe, and virtually as soon as they landed in New York City, they brought them to Messina, and they became workers in the plant. So the complexion of Messina changed. Many foreign languages were spoken, etc. And the population, the natives looked with distrust and dismay upon these alien faces and strange tongues grated on their ears. For the most part, the newcomers were Roman Catholic, and the natives feared that these immigrants, together with the French Canadians and the Irish, would swamp them in a Catholic sea. Now let's turn to the Jewish community. Messina had a small Jewish community. It began in the 1890s. By 1920, it consisted of about 20 families. They were virtually all Orthodox Jews. And in 1920, they had reached the point where they wanted a rabbi, and also they were concerned to have kosher food, kosher meat in particular. So they hired a rabbi, Beryl Brenglass, as what's called a shochet, that's a ritual slaughterer. He was a cantor, a baal tefillah, a chazan. He was a teacher, a religious teacher, and he was the rabbi of the community. He was European trained, he had a strong personality, and he came to Upper New York State originally because he suffered from tuberculosis. And he had a brother-in-law who was a physician who recommended to him that he relocate to Upper New York State. That would help him. Rabbi Brenglass was the spiritual leader of the Messina Jewish community from 1918 to 1941. In appearance, he was a Lenin look-alike and sound-alike. A Van Dyke beard lent dignity to his 5-foot-2-inch frame. Steel, discerning eyes, silhouetted from him, and anyone who tangled with him knew that he was somebody that you had to be careful with. His words were powerful and commanding, his demeanor was courageous and authoritative, and his advertories in the blood libel incident of 1928 were to discover that he played a key role in the case. It is possible the outcome of that near tragedy might have been disastrous in the hands of a lesser man. A more intimate picture of him reveals him as a loving family man devoted to his wife and children. He was born in Troiki, Lithuania in 1876, and he was graduated from what is the famous Slabodka Yeshiva in Europe. It was the primary training ground of Orthodox rabbis, and he ended up spending some time in Cardiff in Wales, where he served as a rabbi. So when he spoke English, he had a peculiar accent in addition to his Yiddish accent. But he left there. He came here to America in 1915, looking to see if it was possible to relocate when he was almost 40 years old. Eventually, he brought his family over here. He regretted all his life that he had not made the move earlier to the United States, because then he might have been able to prepare for the legal or medical profession. In any case, Rabbi Brenglass is the religious leader of Messina, again, from 1918 to 1941, when his wife passed away. And he held the community together. There was no instance of intermarriage in Messina during his tenure as rabbi. Small Jewish community. Now we come to Yom Kippur, That's the Day of Atonement. That is a fast day in the Jewish calendar, a very holy day in the Jewish calendar. In 1928, first let's back up, all Jewish holidays begin the night before, because in the Bible it says it was evening, it was day. The first day it was evening, it was day. The second day. So from there, Judaism derives that the day begins at night, at sunset, and ends the following night when it gets dark. And Yom Kippur came out on Monday, which means it started on Sunday, on September 23rd, 1928. The day before, on September 22nd, a four-year-old girl, Barbara Griffiths, got lost in the woods. She went off. The woods at that time were very close to Messina. She lived near the edge of town. Her brothers had gone to play, and she went off to find them, and she disappeared. She disappeared. And when she didn't return, her parents, of course, became concerned, and a search was mounted. And the longer that she was missing, the more the search was increased. There was great concern. After all, it was in September. Nights in Messina at that time can be cold and damp. Who knows what could have happened to her? The fire department became the key players in the search. However, the fire department included several Ku Klux Klan members, and this was part of the problem eventually. A rumor started. Nobody is quite sure how or who started it. The claim is that it was started by a Greek Orthodox person who owned a restaurant who had arrived recently in America. And he said that he remembered from the old country that the Jews killed children. They kidnapped them, they killed children, they used their blood as part of their ritual. And isn't there a holiday coming up, starting soon? The rumor began to spread. The mayor bought it, essentially. There were two state troopers who were stationed nearby. They were called in, and they bought it also. They questioned a young Jewish man with limited mental ability, and his answers were strange. He was not all there. That's agreed by everybody. And then they questioned a fellow who worked at the Alcoa plant, who was a Jew but who knew absolutely nothing about Judaism. He had been raised in orphan homes, he knew nothing about Judaism, and his answers also were strange. So the conclusion that was arrived at was, it must be the Jews. The Jews must have kidnapped Barbara to use her blood as part of the ritual. And this spread. I'm not saying that everybody believed it, but it was certainly in the air. What did they decide to do? Well, who should you question? Let's go to the rabbi. Whether or not the rabbi had heard anything of the ugly developments is not known, but presumably somebody had alerted him. When Trooper McCain, that's one of the state troopers, appeared at around noon, this is on Sunday, which is the eve of Yom Kippur, outside of his front door, the rabbi quickly denounced the trooper's impudence in disturbing him so shortly before what's called Kol Nidre. That's the special prayer that begins the Yom Kippur festival, the Day of Atonement festival. With righteous wrath, he sharply scolded the man for the incredible gall of raising the ancient and terrible charge of ritual murder. He refused to accompany him to the town hall, but said that he would appear later to make a voluntary statement. He wasn't about to be pushed around. Not long afterward, he walked briskly down to the police station. When the mayor and the trooper attempted to put questions to him, the rabbi quickly and vehemently turned the tables on them, demanding to know who was responsible for this contemptible libel. In no uncertain terms, he denounced all who dared to accuse Jews of such heinous crimes in the 20th century, particularly in these enlightened United States. Certainly, all of them should hang their heads in shame, he said. After delivering his angry speech, so he wouldn't answer any questions, he berated them. After his speech, he left abruptly. There is a report that as he walked out, there was a crowd that was assembled around the police station. And he said to them, "Why are you standing here? Why aren't you out looking for the girl? How dare you even think that Jews would do this? Some say it didn't actually happen. Others say it really did happen. About an hour or two later, this is on Sunday afternoon now, around 4 o'clock, little Barbara Griffiths walked out of the woods and was found wandering on the road. What had happened was she had gone into the woods looking for her brothers. It had gotten dark, so she lay down and fell asleep. She was absolutely, perfectly fine. So, of course, this was a great relief. However, there was an aftermath. Because who knows what would have happened if she hadn't appeared at that point? Who knows? The true hero was Rabbi Brenglass of sainted memory. Had Messina's rabbi been of a different character, one shudders to think what might have happened. His magnetic, piercing eyes, neat Van Dyke beard, steel gray hair, partially hidden by an old-fashioned yarmulke, that's a skullcap, made him an impressive figure. He knew what had to be said and was not afraid to say it. He had dressed down the state trooper who had come to his house to summon him to the police station. And later on, at the police station, he spoke to the mayor and the troopers in no uncertain terms. He was a man of surpassing moral and physical courage, and his message came through in that volatile situation. A gentleman by the name of Samuel Jacobs, who grew up in Messina and who for many years was the head of the Jewish community, was 9 years old at the time of this blood libel. And he writes, though I was only a child, I remember his charge to the community to stand up as proud Jews. This was at the Yom Kippur service that night, on Sunday night. And staunch Americans against all anti-Semitism. He inspired all of us, old and young, and we emerged from the synagogue that night with our heads held high and physically unafraid. Now, Jacobs, when he writes about this, is troubled by some things. The Jews of Messina got along very well with their neighbors. They interacted nicely. They had been there for 30 years, approximately, so that their neighbors knew them. And yet, he cannot help but express his disappointment at his non-Jewish neighbors. One must here digress for a moment and express, even at this very late date, 1979, the intense disappointment which the Jewish people felt at the silence of the good people of Messina. We know that many people, perhaps most, did not really believe any of this. Furthermore, relations between Jews and Gentiles had been excellent, and the Jewish people were an integral part of the civic and business life of this northern New York village. Nevertheless, that Sunday morning, not a single minister or priest urged his congregants to refrain from listening to such rumors against the Jews, rumors which were so contrary to both Jewish and Christian religious morality, human decency, and the American concept of religious freedom. Surely, from their close relationships with Jews for over 30 years, the people of Messina could have known that something like this was unthinkable. There was not only silence on the pulpits or from the pulpits, not a word about the incident ever appeared in the Messina Observer, that's the local newspaper. There seems to have been a silent consensus to hush the whole matter up. He's disturbed, and understandably so. By the way, the press got wind of this, the New York Times, other papers, and the mayor was eventually forced, and I say forced because pressure was put upon him, to issue an apology to the Jewish community, but only after he was pressured for a number of weeks after the incident. The trooper was forced to resign. There was a big to-do about it in the press. The 1928 libel in Messina did indeed occur. Amazing that such a thing should occur in America. I mean, it's mind-boggling in a certain sense to believe that people would kill little children and drain their blood and use it in some sort of ritual purpose. I mean, it's almost mind-boggling. It was extremely serious, and the accusation was directed at the entire Jewish community. Who knows what the consequences might have been if the little girl had not been found. The libel itself was brought to the community by someone who had been raised abroad in an anti-Semitic environment. Unfortunately, the volunteer fire department had a number of Ku Klux Klan members, and they were very quick to jump on this. But the Jews, because they experienced religious freedom in America, were unafraid to stand up for their rights and to object. But I want to make something clear to you. This blood libel is still, unfortunately, very much alive and well. You may say to me, how can that be? In today's world, there should be such a thing? But we see today a resurgence of anti-Semitism, in particular in certain Muslim circles. And in March of 2002, there were two articles published by the Saudi government daily Al-Riyad by a columnist by the name of Dr. Umayma Ahmed Al-Julama of the King Faisal University in Al-Damam. And he wrote the following about what's called the Jewish holiday of Purim. We have a festival that comes about a month before Passover, which is based on the Book of Esther, in which the Jews were miraculously saved from the wicked Haman, the wicked Haman. And one of the features of that holiday is the eating of what's called Hamantaschen. These are triangular pastries that are filled with either apricot or matzmon prune, various other things. Okay, they're tasty things. Anyway, he writes the following. He describes how blood is a necessary ingredient of the making of very special pastries eaten by Jews on Purim. The columnist tells the story of the Book of Esther and concludes, quote, since then, the Old Testament, the Jewish holy book, requires the Jews to glorify this holiday and show their joy. This joy can only be complete with the consumption of pastries mixed with human blood. This was published in 2002 in a respected newspaper. And this gentleman is has a respected position at this university. And it continues, and it continues. It is, when I first found out about it, that a blood libel should occur in America in 1928, I was astounded. How could it be? Well, in Europe, in ancient times, although I knew that there was the famous Bilas trial in Russia, in which Bilas was accused also in the early part of the 20th century of a blood libel, he was eventually acquitted. I knew that such things occurred, but in America, it's hard to believe. But it indeed happened. It really did happen. Thank you.
Now you say the blood libel continues to reverberate in the world, and you cited this example in Saudi Arabia. I'm sure you would agree that it's a very insignificant event in the world today. And in the United States, where fewer than 2% of the people deny the Holocaust, I would think fewer than 1% have any sense of blood libel.
I don't think that the average American, if you stopped him or her in the street, would even know what I'm talking about. That
some
I will agree with you.
Some of our colleagues, by the way, don't know.
That some of our colleagues don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, okay, that's one of the reasons to talk about it. I mean, this is a learning experience, what it is.
Prevalent.
And educate, okay. But again, I agree with you that in America, this is really, people don't know about it, and okay. But I have to disagree with you a little bit when it comes to other places in the world. The Protocols of Zion, which is an anti-Semitic book which claims that the Jews control the world, is being sold in large quantities in the Arab world. There was an entire, I think it was a 50-week session on Egyptian television which portrayed the Protocols of Zion. There are, unfortunately, incidents, and I'm not saying that it's all Muslims, I'm not saying it's all this, all I'm saying is that this does exist in certain circles. Okay, now, how significant it is, I don't know. I hope it's not significant at all. Yes, Harold.
A point of information. That area of upper New York State,
yeah,
in the second half of the 19th century, was a center of intense religious ferment. And that's where Mormonism originated.
Yeah, that's where, what's his name,
Joseph Smith,
yeah, discovered, it's around there? Yes, yeah. First of all, there was intense religious, quote-unquote, fervor in many places in America.
Very strong.
But I mean, there were other, it was not the only place that was isolated. And I will agree with you that any sort of intense religious fervor tends to lead to strange things, and not such good things sometimes. Yes. Sir?
I have just a question just occurred to me as you were giving your talk. In the story of Passover, there is the portion of the story where the Jews who were enslaved in Egypt are told to put blood on the doorposts of their house, the angel of death come in,
and I was from a sheep, blood from a sheep.
Blood from a sheep. I'm sorry. I was wondering if that tradition continued at all past the time of the period when the Jewish people were in Egypt, whether that continued in the observance of Passover for some time afterwards, and it just occurred to me that that's part of that story, and also this blood being associated with matzah frequently occurs. I was wondering if you thought about any of those things.
The putting of the putting of the blood on the door was only for that time.
Only at
that one time. That was a commandment, according to the Bible, of that one time period.
Never happened subsequently.
No. Now blood is mentioned at the Passover Seder. Because one of the plagues is that all the water turned to blood. So that's mentioned. But other plagues are mentioned too. Okay? And again, I want to stress that the avoidance of blood is something that Jewish ritual law stresses. Again, kosher meat, when the animal is slaughtered, the blood has to be drained. Then the meat is what's called made kosher, which means it's soaked. It's salted and soaked because the salt helps draw out the blood. And otherwise, the meat is not considered kosher. So, but the idea that was just at that one time, and that was something that the Jews were supposed to. It showed a certain courageousness, because you have to understand that the lamb was a god of the Egyptians, and the fact that the Jews had the nerve to slaughter what the Egyptians considered a god, and then put the blood there, was standing up in a certain sense to that idolatry. Anyone else? Well, I thank you, folks. Thank you. Thank you.